Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast, which strives to provide you with the most thoughtful and articulate literary analysis at the risk of turning out a bit dull. Back when we did the rebrand, I remember when we rebranded as Book Spider, I remember getting very excited about the idea of just completely going with the joke of this is a boring podcast and really like riffing on it and running it into the ground. And now I get kind of scared every time I actually start to do that, but whatever. I am Hans Berger. I'm one of the three hosts of Book Spider. It's been suggested to me that we could have the other two hosts introduce themselves so that people know who those voices are. So, Chris?
I am Chris Momberg.
And Patrick?
That's me. I'm Patrick. Barney.
So this week, regular listeners will note that at the end of last episode, we promised Gate of the Sun by Patrick. Who's the author for that?
Pronounced in my crappy American accent. Elias Khoury. I'm sure it's more something like Khoury or whatever.
So the plan had been to do Gate of the Sun by Elias Khoury, but due to, you know, just difficulty getting the thing and making it through it on time, we're doing a little bit of a bonus episode here on Don DeLillo's novella Pafko at the Wall. This makes Don DeLillo, I believe, the only author to be a three-time focus here for this podcast, which is appropriate because DeLillo is very appropriate or very, very close to my heart, at least. Probably beyond the level of rationality. But we're talking about DeLillo's 1992 novella Pafko at the Wall, which later, under the title of The Triumph of Death, became the first chapter of his immense postmodern mega novel Underworld, which is generally regarded as a magnum opus of his, although often I think regarded as uneven and imperfect. And I think at this point is one of those books that is so often referred to as overrated that it may now have become underrated, right? But I think part of the legend of Underworld is that the first 50 pages, which, you know, were published several years before as a novella, that those first 50 pages are maybe not only the best part of Underworld, but maybe the best thing that DeLillo ever wrote. I don't know if I agree with them being the best part of Underworld, and I do actually, I'm very fond of how the novella sits within the larger structure of Underworld, but it is also an interesting thing to consider on its own, and it, you know, it has kind of a literary profile as a freestanding work. So, Pafko at the Wall is reasonably focused on probably the closest thing you could call to a protagonist, which is Cotter. Cotter's a black teenager who skips school to attend the 1951 National League Finals between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers. Almost all of the events in the novel or the novella occur within the stadium during the game. And the 1951 National League Finals, of course, end with a home run nicknamed The Shot Heard Round the World. I am not going to go into all the kind of sporting details of why that was significant because I'm not really that familiar with them myself. But suffice to say that it ended with a dramatic home run that was regarded as a very striking moment in the history of baseball. In addition to Cotter, our viewpoint roves to a few other characters, primarily celebrities. J. Edgar Hoover is there. He's sitting with Frank Sinatra and Jackie Gleason and Toots Shore, who's a nightclub owner who probably is not as well known as the other folks. More of someone whose celebrity was more time-bound than Sinatra or Gleason. I suppose even Gleason has kind of faded into the mist of history at this point for anybody under, you know, 60, but everybody still knows who Frank Sinatra is. But Frank Sinatra, Jackie Gleason, Toots Shore, they're all sitting together talking shit, throwing up hot dogs, chatting with J. Edgar Hoover, who during the game is informed of another shot heard around the world, which is the first Soviet test of a hydrogen bomb. And Cotter catches the ball. Catches the game ball after a struggle with a man named Bill, who for most of the game has seemed to be his friend. Cotter takes the ball home, and that is really the events in the novella. So I don't always do this, but this time I just kind of wanted to lead off by having the other hosts talk about their initial reactions to the piece. Patrick, I know you've always had mixed feelings about DeLillo, though I think you've kind of come around a bit to some of the things we've covered for the podcast. Chris, I think you're usually a DeLillo fan. And I think that, you know, like I said earlier, the general consensus among readers and DeLillo fans is that this is the best 50 pages of writing that DeLillo ever did. So do you guys like it? Do you agree with that assessment based on your sense of the work? Chris, how did you feel about it?
I adored it. It's like a melange of different things, you know, that I think kind of braid together really well to be kind of balanced. Like, it's very, very thoughtful in that way that DeLillo can be, where there's a line that you read and it just sort of like kind of vaults out of the frame of the novel and or out of the frame of the story and seems to kind of like carry like an immense amount of weight. Like, I have one here: fame and secrecy are the high and low ends of the same fascination, the static crackle of some libidinous thing in the world. And Edgar, that's J. Edgar Hoover, responds to people who have access to this energy. There's like lines like that. There's Frank Sinatra giving Jackie Gleason shit for vomiting on his shoes, which is funny. There's like kind of a sort of seems like a very sincere appreciation of the game of baseball. You know, of just like the texture of the game and the plays and stuff like that. And it all shouldn't, I think, fit into the frame that it's given, but somehow it does. And yeah, it's just really impressive and really enjoyable, and I loved it.
Do you think that it is, I mean, you've read a fair amount of DeLillo for the podcast and other things. Do you think that it's fair to put it among his best work?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, like, a listicle sort of treatment, I think it's fair to put it among his best work. I think when you start sort of saying, like, this is the best, you know, best of piece of writing that DeLillo's ever done, I don't really always think of, like, when I think of, like, how much I love the names, like, it's hard for me to pick out, there's a bunch of different like pieces of the names that are really, really impressive, but there's the kind of like the whole thing, the whole sort of like the whole structure of the names, the whole structure of that novel that like really, I don't know, like has kind of mystical power over me. And I don't, you know, I think that like this is like really tight, but it's a novella. Like it's supposed to be super tight. You know, a novel's supposed to be big and shaggy. So like, I think that while it's definitely like, I definitely am very comfortable considering it some of his best work that I've read, I think that like ranking his works, his novellas against this, or this novella against his novels, doesn't quite make sense to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think each of his classic novels sort of spotlights a different aspect of what makes him successful that might appeal to different people. I mean, White Noise is like very thematic and very point-driven, and I think that works for a lot of people. Like, it teaches well, right? Like, it's a good book to use in a classroom because it's very, very easy to extract themes from it. And it kind of only gets away with that because it's so entertaining. Whereas The Names is, like, much more kind of atmospheric and mystical and, like, a kind of, you know, has this kind of cipher quality where you really don't know what the hell it's doing. But I think like just the play of kind of image and texture and language is very, you know, if that's more what you come to DeLillo for, that's going to be something that you think is a better book. And Libra is very sentimental, I think, in a way that a lot of his other work is perceived not to be. And so, you know, if you want a version of DeLillo that has kind of more emotional depth to it, Libra is very good for that. I like Mautou a lot, but I don't know if it does any of those things the best. I guess it might actually kind of be, it might actually be a better thesis novel than White Noise, right? Like it's a thesis novel in a somewhat more subtle and complex way than White Noise. And I think actually if you want kind of the thesis-driven DeLillo, but you don't want it to be quite so obvious, I think Mautou is really good for that.
Yeah, you want it to be more subtextual. Mautou is better for the subtext.
And something, yeah, and something with a certain amount of it does actually a pretty good job of kind of blending the mystery and the mystery of the names, the kind of mysterious atmosphere of the names, and the kind of thematic, overt thematicness of White Noise. But yeah, I mean, Pafko at the Wall, I think, as a freestanding piece, is it captures, I think, his kind of the fun aspect of DeLillo, right? Because like he can be a very fun writer. He's someone who has, he clearly has a lot of fun writing. He has a lot of fun setting up absurd situations and playing around with bizarre ideas and kind of, you know, juxtaposing things that normally you wouldn't think to. And that sense of play is part of what he does that I think can sometimes be subsumed by people's sense of his like capital I importance, you know? And I think this maybe has a greater sense of play in it than any other DeLillo work. It is both about play and written in a playful way. And I think that probably might partly account for why people are so, why it's so beloved, right? And why, you know, it works better for people than Underworld as a whole, which is, it has the opposite of that kind of novella tightness that you mentioned, right? Like Underworld is as shaggy as DeLillo gets, and just probably generally as shaggy as well-regarded literary fiction gets about. But Patrick, how did you feel about Pafko at the Wall?
I mildly enjoyed it. You know, it's fine. Like, I'm not the DeLillo fan that you guys are. Like, I do try to be generous and open, you know, when I approach DeLillo, because like he is so well regarded, so I don't want to like, you know, toss him aside just because like reading the names made me want to like screw my head with a drill, you know. Right.
That's a pretty good reason to toss him aside, actually.
Well, I mean, it was years ago.
I mean, you tossed him aside, but he keeps coming. He's like a, you know, boomerang garbage, right? You toss him aside and he just keeps coming back and smacking you in the head again.
Well, it was years ago. Like, I was a different person. So, like, I want to change. I want to adapt. I want to, you know, at least make sure that I am trying. So I would say, like, where it ranks among the DeLillo texts I've read is probably closer to the better side than the worse side. So, like, you know, on the better side, maybe, you know, for me, like, you got White Noise and Cosmopolis. And then on the far bad side, you've got, like, obviously the names, and then in the middle, maybe Mautou for me. So it's probably like better than Mautou or more enjoyable than Mautou. May not be better. Like none of this, I'm not saying anything about like its actual quality. I'm just saying my reaction. So, you know, it is. It definitely, there are things that I'm interested in about it, like, and I, you know, thematically, and I think we'll get to that. But so that, there's definitely that, like in a later question, you mentioned like J. Edgar Hoover's encounter with an apocalyptic Bruegel painting. That was cool. there's this thick mist of nostalgia surrounding the story, like this baseball nostalgia, which maybe I am a little partial to. Like, I like baseball. I think baseball's interesting, and I do think that the history of baseball is interesting. Like, and this kind of happens within the golden age of baseball, or maybe, like, I'm not sure exactly where you'd put that golden age. Maybe some people would say it's like 20 or 30 years earlier, like when Babe Ruth is playing. At least I think Babe Ruth is like in the 20s and 30s. Yeah, it's definitely, it was definitely interesting in some ways.
Yeah, and I don't personally like baseball at all. I don't dislike it. It just, I don't know, it's like vanilla ice cream to me, you know? Actually, I like vanilla ice cream a fair amount. But baseball is, it's like a Toyota Camry or something, you know? It's this very kind of bland, neutral, cultural object. But I find the kind of history and culture of sports much, much more interesting than actually watching a game, you know? And I think, like, as a... I don't know. Like, I wondered a bit about, as I was coming back to this, I wondered a bit about the ways in which it does kind of serve as this, like, nostalgic, kitschy period detail artifact, right? But it's very aware of its own artifactuality and of the ways in which it is overtly mythical. And, you know, I think if I were to encounter this for the first time now without the bias of, you know, this is a great thing by someone I value, I probably would have a harder time overcoming the annoyance of, oh, this is a bunch of nostalgic, kitschy period detail, right? Because in theory, I sort of hate that. And I don't have any fondness at all for the 50s or any of the things that are being represented here. I don't know if there's something maybe about the ways in which it is so overt in its nostalgic kitschiness that make it easier to approach. I don't know if, like, the, it's almost kind of like it doesn't make any effort to pretend to be representing an actual thing, right? It makes it, it's clear that it's representing kind of the myth and the memory of a thing. At least I think it is. I don't know. Maybe there's an interesting separation here between, like, the ground, like the kind of twin lenses of Cotter and the, you know, Hoover and the Hoover and Sinatra. Maybe there's an effect there where you have both kind of like the real ground level experience of the time as seen through Cotter and the mythical nostalgic version of the time as experienced by those two, by that kind of group of celebrities. Maybe that the union of the two is maybe part of what's interesting here. I don't know.
Yeah. I think, what you said about the mythical, like the overtly mythical made me think about the voice of the novella and how there's a you that, you know, it's addressing the reader, I guess, right? Like, is that how you read that, Hans? Like, you see this?
It is, yeah. He speaks in your voice, American.
Yeah.
I mean, it's addressing not just, it's addressing a kind of imagined reader that has a particular relationship to the material.
Yeah, it there's something about that feels like it is drawing us into the kind of mythical storytelling mode. And I think that there's space in the themes of the novella surrounding, you know, it talks about, you know, history at times, like, I don't remember, the Dempsey boxing fight. There's a character who looks back or is thinking back to the Dempsey fight, you know, and there's a line there about how when you're present at these, famous moments, you become part of those famous moments. I'm really making a hash of that. But it feels like the scrabble for the ball that Cotter eventually gets control of and leaves with, and the presence of these mythical figures and the mythical nature of the game itself and what happened at the end, it does kind of feel like there's something being said or some kind of tension around the mythical quality of this one singular experience. And then that's connected to, as you said, the hydrogen bomb testing by the USSR. And I don't exactly know what to do with all of that. You know, maybe maybe you've read this, I think, quite a bit more than I have. Whether that's just something that is like an ambience, or whether that's saying something about American myth making. But I enjoyed it.
It's probably more an ambience. I don't know that I could. Well, it's very hard for me, first of all, it's very hard for me to kind of separate a thematic analysis of just this piece from a thematic analysis of all of Underworld. But I would say that, like, Underworld as a whole is much more atmospheres around a particular set of images. It's basically garbage plus myth, garbage plus American myth plus the fear of atomic annihilation. Those three ideas spun into atmosphere for 1,000 pages. And I don't think that it has, it's not, you can't really pull a thesis out of it so much as just kind of a meditation on the mood of those things, which might be part of why, you know, people don't love Underworld as a whole. But I do think that, like, just thinking about PAFCO at the Wall on its own, it is, I think, much more about the aura and myth of those things. And I suppose about the, maybe about the experience of touching myth in real time in a way, right? The experience of, like, momentarily being part of something that you almost immediately understand is going to exist as a story. The kind of the brush between the normal and the epic. And that you know, the last line in the novella, which I called out in one of my planned questions, was, it is all falling indelibly into the past. And I mean, I guess everything is falling indelibly into the past all the time, right? I said when I was writing the questions that particular line, I've read this novella several times, and that particular line always catches me in this particular way and gets sadder as I get older. And I don't even, I mean, it's not a particularly clever or original idea. But it's just kind of has that quality of being a well-understood thing phrased in a very effective way. And I think that the quality of, maybe what it captures for me is, like, that sense of the few times in your life that you have an experience that you know in that moment is going to be something you'll look back on and look back on and look back on and cling to the memory of and build myth out of, you know. For me, it usually, those moments have pretty much always tended to occur around sex and dating. And I've never had kind of an experience with a big event of this sort, right? But I think that there's an effect where, you know, like, Cotter has the ball, he has his little piece of history, he has his piece of myth, and then he, like, goes home, and he's kind of back in the real world, and it's just a ball in spite of everything, you know? That kind of, that fading from that sort of brilliant moment of myth back into day-to-day life. I think that there's something about that idea that I find very moving, right? That kind of, the way that the sort of golden glow of transcendence settles and contracts and dims, you know, like a light turning off, and the kind of normal contours of the world reestablish themselves. The last time I read this novel, I had probably just turned 30. I was a couple years away, a couple years after turning 30, and I was very aware, I think, of the sense that the number of experiences I had in my 30s that had that kind of mythical quality would be much lower than the number that I'd had in my 20s, right? No matter what I did. And maybe that's why that line resonated with me personally, you know? I don't know. I'm rambling rather badly here, worse than I normally do on this podcast.
Well, I have an idea that I'm interested that is connected to this glow of mythologizing the past that you're talking about. So you point out that Cotter, like, he gets the ball, he's at a high point. You know, this is a moment that's going to kind of etch itself in his memory forever. And, you know, he's got that glow that you're talking about. And then he realizes, you know, that he doesn't want to go to school tomorrow. You know, so he has this settling into reality that you're talking about. And I'm interested in how this is juxtaposed with specifically the character of J. Edgar Hoover. So, like, we've got J. Edgar Hoover, but we also got Frank Sinatra, Jackie Gleason, and the other guy who's less famous. And, you know, there's definitely, like, talking about these golden age celebrities like Jackie Gleason and Frank Sinatra, there's definitely some mythologizing around that. But when we get to J. Edgar Hoover, my reaction is a lot different. Like, I think it's interesting to, like, see things from Hoover's perspective, but also Hoover himself has a lot of baggage, right? Like, he throughout his career as a law enforcement officer, he's known for illegal wiretaps. He's known for trying to persecute, not trying to, but actually persecuting subversives and radicals, and being frustrated when he's not allowed to, like, punish them judicially as much as he wants. And we've also got his, like things like COINTELPRO and his attempts to actually get Martin Luther King to kill himself. Like, Hoover's a bad fucking dude, like, is what I'm saying. He's not a good person. I'm not saying that a work needs to, like, have a good person as a character. Like, Hoover's a perfectly interesting character in this novel, so I like that. But I'm wondering, like, what does Hoover's presence, how does that make us rethink this air of nostalgia that's going on in the story? Like, how does that affect the air of nostalgia and this glow of mythologizing that you've been talking about? Like, when we've got this really awful dude who did really awful things within this golden age moment. That makes me wonder what the novella is saying about history. Like, it can't just be mythologizing history. There's got to be a point to choosing Hoover as a character, right? Not just, like, even if he really was at the game, which I'm sure he was, that doesn't mean he has to be a character, right?
I have a bit of a take on it. I'm sure that Hans's is probably more developed, so he can chime in with his. But hearing you talk about it, Patrick, it occurred to me that, like, there is sort of this is kind of the I don't know if it's always portrayed this way, but like it feels like this would be the end of that kind of period that we are so nostalgic for, you know, before the Cold War really ramps up into mutually assured concern, like concerns about mutually assured destruction. You know, this is an American, you know, people that is riding a high of sort of like global power and really you know, J. Edgar Hoover is aware of developments that are going to basically fracture that dream of being sort of untouchably brilliant and great and the best of the world. And whether that's true or not, I'm not saying that that's true. I think that that's, you know, that's somewhat of a construction. And I don't know that the novella needs to, for me anyway, reflect what it was actually like at the game or actually like at that time, but how we talk about or how we think about an America of old, you know, you sort of center it on this very widely understood American pastime, the American pastime of baseball. And you said it at this time when we are kind of untouchable and all of that is washing away really quickly on the global stage. And it's going to be very different very soon. So I think that Hoover being aware of that, at least for me, sort of heralds the end of a kind of dreamy time. And also, you know, he has yet to do a lot of his worst things. This Hoover that we're sitting with in the novella. And so like it's also the end of a lot of the it's kind of the beginning, like really like the 50s, 60s, JFK, obviously, but like the death of Martin Luther King and the attempts by the FBI to discredit King or make him kill himself. It's sort of the beginning of this like really like fundamental mistrust of our institutions, right? Like this like we used to like the greatest generation is the greatest generation in part because they were this bridge between the populace, the you know, civilians who became soldiers in the great wars, and in at a time when the institutions that were sort of like leading those wars were we trusted them in a way that we don't now. And so I see it kind of as him as sort of heralding the end of a lot of what we are nostalgic for, whether those things actually existed, those things that we're nostalgic for ever existed in the first place.
And I think too, I mean, again, you know, I'm going to have trouble here separating my sense of this bit from my sense of Underworld as a whole, right? But like one of the things that Underworld as a whole is interested in is the contrast between the contrast between the myth and the thing under the myth, right? The underworld, the contrast between the kind of golden myth of a time or the legend of a time or a person and the sort of buried things that are several layers below the surface of a society or of a person. And I think that Hoover is very interesting because he is a channel between those worlds, right? Hoover in the context of the baseball game, Hoover serves as a portal between the public myth of America and the secrets of America. Hoover is a kind of turning point, or maybe turning point's the wrong word. Hoover's a point of communication in a way between the sort of public face of a lot of different things. And the buried, deeper, secret history of a thing, you know? He's this kind of celebrity figure. He's moving with celebrities, but he's also a keeper of secret histories. How about Cotter and Bill, right? The dynamic between Cotter and Bill, the kind of the initial friendliness, the way that they bond over this romantic idea of baseball, and then the meanness that emerges once Cotter has the ball and Bill wants it. That's really the closest thing we have to a dramatic arc. And I think in a way also something that, you know, like the thing that I was saying about like Hoover being a point of communication between the sort of mythical glow version of America and the buried secret history of America. There's a version of that here too, I think, where you have Bill very, very concerned with the kind of myth of baseball and the traditions of baseball, right? He's, you know, he treats the seventh inning stretch as a very sacred thing. And his relationship to Cotter is very premised on this classical, mythical version of baseball as an American tradition. And then once a certain amount of, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess material imbalance basically comes into play. Well, put it simpler, once Cotter has something that Bill wants, like that mask slips away and there's this undercurrent of meanness and greed that immediately comes out, right? And that's actually, I think, in a way, it corresponds in a way to kind of the what Hoover is representing, right? The kind of 50s kitsch with the both the, you know, the bigotry and the atomic paranoia and all that below that, right? And I mean DeLillo is very aware of what Hoover represents, right? DeLillo is writing, I think, to an audience, and again, I say this having read the whole book, right? Like, DeLillo is writing to an audience that he expects to understand that Hoover is, in fact, kind of one of the, you know, if not one of the great monsters of the 20th century, like one of the great monsters of American government, right? In the 20th century, you know, maybe not like a Jackson or a, you know, something, but like someone who like represents the worst of his time, right? Like almost kind of like a net that kind of scoops up the worst impulses and feelings of his time, right? Like DeLillo is aware of that. And I think that there's an interesting correspondence between like the way that Hoover shows kind of the myth and the truth, or the myth and the buried history, and the way that like the interaction between Bill and Cotter represents a myth giving way to deeper, nastier impulses, right? What did you guys think about that dynamic and those characters?
I didn't notice it as much as like I should have, probably. Like when I was like, obviously when you get to the end and there's Cotter and Bill are scrabbling after the ball and like almost coming to blows over it. And then I guess what happens is that Cotter gets back to his neighborhood and Bill is too scared to follow him. I think I read that right.
Yeah.
That's yeah, my understanding as well. Like Bill realizes like, oh shit, I am in
a black neighborhood,
kind of a bad part of town. And this kid is a lot more comfortable right, here right, than right, I am, right. And I need to
like do you think that is like a specific comment about racial inequality or at least like is a way to point at like the racial inequality seething under the surface in America, like Bill becoming uncomfortable in this neighborhood that Cotter, a black teenager, feels fine in?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a way of acknowledging it, right? I think once again it comes back to the transition between and the kind of the meeting point between, I've been using these phrases a lot, but the golden myth and the secret history, right? There's actually a surprising amount of subtlety to the way that that point about race is made, I think, right? Because, like, this isn't mostly a very subtle work, and DeLillo, when he does have an idea about something, is not at all a subtle writer. He can be very enigmatic, but when he's not enigmatic, he's very direct. And I think the subtlety of how the idea about race is kind of tossed in there casually is deceptive, right? It's an interesting move in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, if I were Bill, I'd be pissed too. I had the ball. There's this kid who's like basically doing Indian burns on my forearm so that I let go of the ball, and then like takes the ball and you know, runs off with it. And it struck me as kind of human. I thought of Mautu a couple times because not even just the idea of, but the word crowds comes up a lot in Path Go at the Wall, and this seething mass of people fighting over a ball is pretty, I don't know, there's something that's kind of there's something animalistic about it, and one other point about the ball is the ball would be worth an incredible, I haven't read Underworld, so I don't know where this goes, but the ball would be worth a lot of money
today.
Days today it'd be worth a ton of money, but there's no provenance. Once someone who's like not actually like bought a ticket, I mean, like, it's just a ball when Cotter takes it away. If someone who had a ticket, you know, like got a picture with it, you know, with some players, you know, hey, I got the ball and here's my ticket, you know, then that creates that provenance, that history, that like, so this ball doesn't have any like economic value, at least as the story ends, because it is just a ball. It's just a fragment of a memory, you know, like I don't think the story does really any work to suggesting that's why people care that much about that ball. It does seem to carry more the mythical weight of the experience of being there. That's why Bill and Cotter are fighting over it. But I couldn't help but read it too, is like, if Bill gets that ball has economic value. And the fact that Cotter takes it, it kind of deletes it from history, you know, in a way. So I don't know, again, how that carries into the book Underworld, or if it completely is fucked over by what actually happens in Underworld. But it seems like I thought I thought that the scrabbling between Cotter and Bill over the ball, while it engaged racial themes, because Bill is white, Cotter's black, Cotter is comfortable in this part of the city and in his building that smells bad. I don't remember what he says it smells like, but sour. And but, you know, it also is just two people fighting over a ball in a way that also it feels like it's there subtly but not overt. And the fact that it's not overt, I don't know what that does to my reading of that, other than it makes it feel a little bit more like a universal thing. Like Cotter being black, while like is clearly a part of the novella, doesn't seem that essential to the fact that him and Bill are fighting over the ball.
No, I don't think it's essential to the fact that they're fighting over the ball. I think the key is the moment when Bill, the key is that he kind of weaponizes that otherness, right? by using Bill's unwillingness to stay in his neighborhood as a way of dodging him, right? So I think it's not so much key in the fact that they're fighting over it as it is key to his ability to keep it. And at the same time, as you said, his deleting of it from history. Like his, in a way, what he's doing is he's kind of like taking a piece of history, removing it from history and kind of subsuming it into the kind of subterrain of the untouchable, right? Or the unrecorded.
Oh, that's a good way of thinking about the race angle on this, which is, you know, I could, now my graduate student research paper for course juices are flowing, like the fact that Cotter taking it into his part of the world is effectively like taking it out of history and out of the things that we pay attention to or think about, and that does feel real.
Yeah, I mean, Black and Indigenous history have been erased in this country since white people came here, right?
Well, I feel like we've actually, it's funny, like I've read this a number of times, but I think that talking about it really has kind of given me a different perspective on it. You know, I'm...
You hate it now.
It's so easy to... I hate it now, yes. It's so easy, I think, to get caught up in the kitschy period detail of it that I think actually, like, it's easy to miss the ways in which it does thematically work pretty well at expressing that kind of fulcrum between the historical and the unrecorded, right? The kind of it sits at this transition point between those two things and kind of represents the movement between those two things. And I actually find that thematically quite interesting and something that ties in, something that sets up the rest of the novel in a really evocative way that to some extent I probably underrated because the surface of period detail is so pleasurable.
And the ideas you two have fleshed out here, like kind of answering my thoughts about J. Edgar Hoover, bringing up the conflict between Cotter and Bill Watterson, that has definitely like made me appreciate the story more, and I think I even should re-listen to it now that like I have a better grasp of it thematically. I think I would enjoy it even more the second, like I thought I enjoyed it the first time around, but I think I would enjoy it even more if I like got it into my head again. So yeah, this is worthwhile.
Cool. All right. Well, Chris, this was your idea, your choice, and I'm really glad you picked it. I'm glad this was what you landed on.
I am too. I
glad you proposed it as our filler.
I you know, we'll see, listeners. You might be hearing from us that we go through the rest of Underworld, and we're talking about ways that we might want to do that, considering that we covered kind of the first chapter of it here. As a separate episode. So, I am hungry once I figure out who frickin' took my copy of Underworld. If you're listening to this and you took my copy of Underworld from my house,
I wonder how many people who personally know you listen to this podcast.
I hope
a very high percentage.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking about the other day that you were, there was that black teenager in your
house. Oh, yeah.
And you wanted
to erase that person from history?
No, I wanted to.
But instead, he erased your copy of Underworld from history. You were going to have it authenticated as Chris Malmberg's copy of Underworld, but now it's just going to travel from hand to hand.
Underworld feels like a prime candidate for the premise of another novel that is, like, I think that it's actually, this is a premise for, this is, what is it called? There's a Spanish or Mexican writer. I know that it's a Spanish name, who wrote a book that's relatively famous about books that are disappearing. I can't remember his name or the premise of the book, but it feels like Underworld would be a prime candidate for a book that exists in like like you said it, Hans, thousands and thousands and thousands of Goodwills across the country, used bookstores, and then suddenly they all start disappearing, and it starts to emerge that no one actually ever read it. No one actually ever read Underworld, and the people who did read Underworld are being assassinated. Luckily, it's just a small number of people.
All right. Well, thanks very much to all the folks who listened to this, and tune in 2 weeks for Gate of the Sun by Elias Khoury.